Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food.
And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Available since the mid-1990s, neonicotinoids, pesticides, have often been used to get rid of poisonous caterpillars, cochineal bugs, aphids, and woodlice. Neonics, even in small amounts, have been blamed for declining bee populations and numbers, significant decline in hive activity, and a rise in bee deaths. So, effectively, a consensus concern lays around seven neurotoxics, toxins, used and actually been regulated and restricted in the EU since 2013. In April, the EU banned a few of these most concerning neonics from their use in the production fields, and regulations are coming into effect just prior to year end. As of September 1st, France has taken things further. Through 2016 biodiversity law, they have now banned neonics in question. This is an agricultural superpower and a thought leader amongst many of our strongest allies who will no longer recognize our practices of bathing in harmful synthetics as a proper approach for moving forward for food production. Today, we welcome Dr. Jonathan Lundgren to tell us more about neonics and some of the clarity what's happening with our operating system that is intrinsically flawed to use these chemicals in the first place. Hello, Jonathan. How are you doing today?
Doing great. How are you?
Well, thanks. We are in September. Summer seems to fly by quicker every year.
Yes. Yep. We're already starting to see the leaves change up here. So.
Yeah. Where are you located, Dr. Lundgren?
South Dakota. Eastern South Dakota, just north of Brookings, about an hour north of Sioux Falls, if you know where that is.
Yeah. We met a few years back, actually, out at the Grass-Fed Exchange in Albany.
And I saw what a great meeting.
It was, yeah. I saw your presentation there, and you gave some additional information which explained that one kernel of GMO corn has enough neonics to kill 360,000 bees. That's pretty potent stuff when using the mass scale, which, from my understanding in your presentation, you said that is now wiping out 50% of the hives annually.
You know, that's probably even an underestimate. I would, that's just 50% of the hives that are, that after they've been requeened. And so the nation right now is requeening almost all of its beehives. And so really that number should be more accurately portrayed as 150% of the nation's bees are being lost every year. Hmm. Queen bees used to live like 3 years. Now they only live 6 months. So we're in dire straits.
We are in dire straits, let me give a quick bit of your background here, and then we'll jump into some questions about that, and really trying to focus on some of the solutions that you've seen. I'd like to get a better understanding of where we can take this in the future based off the current playing field that we're in. So Dr. Jonathan Lundgren is the founder and director of, am I saying this right, Ecdysis Foundation. He's got his PhD from University of Illinois. He is set on changing the minds of farmers around the world, backed on the research he does at Blue Dasher Farm Lab. So, yep. Dr. Lundgren, if you could share with us some of those solutions you have found to deal with this epidemic around neonics.
Well, it's not just a neonic thing, and that's an important point to raise. Neonicotinoids are just one symptom of the problem. There's a perceived need for pesticide use in the U.S. But really, what the farmers that are really pushing ecological agriculture have taught me is that when you change your focus and when you change the system and what your goals are out of that farming system, that suddenly insect pests, other pest species just kind of fall by the wayside. They become less and less important and less pertinent. So how do they attain that? Well, there's a wide range of different practices that farmers can use in order to try to reduce not just pesticide use, but agrochemical use in general, and to start fostering soil health and biodiversity on their farms. Those practices vary depending on the farming operation, right? I mean, if you're a beef producer down in Georgia, you're going to use different practices than somebody up in North Dakota, or a cropping system in New Mexico will look much different than in Illinois. So the practices vary, but they're unified in how they're approaching things by principles. And so these principles that unify ecological agriculture, what we're calling regenerative agriculture, are really straightforward. Number one is that the farmers that have kind of coined this term and really promoted the use of regenerative farming say stop tilling the soil. Soil disturbance is a problem, okay, and tillage is a very, very damaging thing. The next principle that unifies these folks is that they never leave bare soil. They always have plants on the ground. And the third principle would be more plant diversity in the farm is important is crucial. The more plant diversity, the better. And then finally, what these farmers are doing is they're integrating livestock and cropland in the same place at the same time.
So this for a long time was obviously a bit of a fringe element, or folks that were doing it either because they believed in those principles and they'd inherited that methodology. But what I have seen, at least in the last few years, and I'd love to get your perspective on this, is how that seems to be changing, how large mainstays, larger groups are starting to toe the water in regenerative-based agricultural models for many reasons. Have you seen the right. same?
Yeah, it's been really remarkable. I mean, there's a strong organic movement, and that's been growing in steam. Regenerative is different than organics, though. I mean, don't necessarily abandon all pesticide use, but you don't often need it anymore. And so they're replacing biodiversity. There's also not a label associated with regenerative, and I think that that's a good thing. Labels are corrupted, and organic doesn't mean the same thing as what are. It doesn't mean that you're getting, some small family farm that is trying to grow biodiversity in soil on their farm. There's industrialized organic, and that's just as bad as conventional. The movement associated with regenerative farming has really, really taken hold, I would say, in the last 5 years or so.
And as being a bit of the front line there, or seeing it from both sides, because you come from a background in the USDA, and I do want to get into that in more detail, but it seems you are now working with those organizations, those frameworks, the wireframe for this future regenerative or resilient-based agricultural models. And are you seeing an approach where each region or bioregion is developing their own methodology, their own operating system, and are we going to be able to stitch that together into a broader movement?
Sure. There's a finite number of tools that can be applied to any food production system, but it's about knitting those different tools. Be it crop selection, be it, cover cropping, interseeding, livestock, mixed herds, integrating those things together into a viable system for your region. And so that's an important thing to remember. Each region is kind of approaching those general principles in their own way and developing very functional systems.
One of the areas that we do focus on here is looking at circular economies, how future of capital could actually be used in instituting some of these best practices, these best regenerative practices at scale. In a conversation that we had with Wood Turner of Agricultural Capital, we learned about their investment approach to buffer the fringes of all their production areas on their permacrops. He described the impact report that they're creating, which is now evaluating the values, the expenditures, the costs, and the positive unintended consequences that have resulted by replenishing natural habitats for pollinators on their investments with elevated standards in their citrus, blueberries, and nut trees. Do you see what agricultural capital is doing as a bit of an anomaly in this circular economy space of looking at it as, to your point, if we're going to solve the neonic problem, we got to start thinking in a systems approach, and those that are financing that future system approach will have better margins and better capacity in the future? Or are they really establishing a new benchmark moving forward?
You know, I mean, the guys that are going a regenerative approach are doing it because it's a good business decision. I mean, we analyze the economics of corn production from a regenerative standpoint and from a conventional neighbor's, you know, kind of standpoint. And the regenerative farms were, you know, cornfields were twice as profitable. So, I mean, it's not like this is entirely just an ideological decision. When you go down this road, you find that it can also be a very profitable decision. And part of that is because rather than just relying on a single commodity like corn or soybeans or beef, which are beholden to all kinds of market fluctuations and troubles abroad and affects those prices pretty substantially. By diversifying out, these regenerative farmers can grow those traditional commodities, but they grow them in a stacked enterprise sort of system. And so, you know, losing their butts on one particular commodity ends up becoming buffered by based on the system and how it's fostering other revenue streams.
We are seeing that in real time, right, with our international tariffs and the effect of commodity bubbles. And we're just producing food for energy production with this approach rather than understanding where that food comes from, not servicing the farmer, the communities that they come from, nor actually the stakeholders like the consumers, you know, the planet themselves. So I hope we can see these as a benchmark for financial models. And to your point, it's a bit of a microcosm and the approach that we're using for financing of reducing risk. So if we can get folks to invest in the vertical stack of regenerative best practices, boy, that'll, I think, help expedite things or at least develop these approaches to prove out a new financial model to mesh with all this excitement and enthusiasm we've seen within the innovation economy, within regenerative best practices. And I think go ahead, please, Jonathan.
No, nearly everybody wins with this kind of a model. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's like when you start tacking on the price of, you know, healthcare and nutrient dense foods and rural communities, and man, I mean, the knock on benefits extend far and wide.
Yeah, and it comes into account too. Like, can we continue with business as usual? Is first of all, like we're talking about with, is the desirability even going to be there for these crops that are bathed in these synthetic neurotoxins? And also, can we continue to corrupt the free gifts we have from nature's bounty, which basically is our soil health and our clean water, which I think we've taken a bit for granted here in the States, where we've had a luxury, a bounty that we have not materialized.
Yeah, I would agree with that entirely. I think we're on the edge of a cliff as far as what our cropland is able to produce or, you know, sustain. And as, you know, as we exploit those resources, you know, we need to be thinking, well, I guess that one of the barriers to a regenerative adoption or the adoption of a regenerative model is that farmers tend to be very risk averse, but I don't think that they're thinking, long-term or even medium-term enough in terms of what is the risk of doing nothing and just continuing on this course. And the risk is pretty severe if we don't start thinking about changing our ways.
I get excited when I see the volumes of consumers, both motivated by what their interest is in the food that they're eating. Also looking at those are their future investors. That group of millennials are individuals that are set to inherit $40 trillion within the next decade. So not only do we have people buying these products, but we've got people looking at this, and I think we are going to get rid of this facade, I hope at least, from the perspective. And maybe, you know, what we've seen in food systems too is it's opening up this regenerative best practice, to your point earlier. Boy, there is no losers here. We actually even get planetary stability from sequestering carbon in the soil, clean water, many of these elements that it almost seems too good to be true, right? And that's maybe the problem of defining this to people is not selling them snake oil. You're actually just reverting back to natural order.
Right, right. That's absolutely true. And it's not like we're saying, okay, we're all going back to Little House on the Prairie here. There are certainly things that we could learn from those early approaches to farming. I think that the farmers were really in tune with what was happening on their land. I think that we have learned a lot in terms of especially ecology and how that can be applied to make those historical systems even more productive. And so, yeah, I would say, you know, this is the Brown Revolution and the Green Revolution, which was, you know, Norman Borlaug's kind of legacy. You know, it worked for a while, but technology just cannot replace biodiversity. Mother Nature tends to find a way to kick us in the crotch when we try to think that we're smarter than she is.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. And yeah, maybe a little bit of a antithesis of the nomenclature here, right? Maybe a little like Iceland and Greenland, right? False promises of the Green Revolution, but the truth and reality is what we have now, which I like the Brown Revolution of looking back to soil health, much in that systems-based approach. So in 2016, the Washington Post reported that you were one of a handful cover-up discussions at the USDA with the past administration. There were numerous claims of the USDA scientists that their research was being tampered or muzzled. And from my understanding and reading this article and just having to hear your story at these different events, they explained that despite you having 11 years within this federal agency, in which you ran your own lab and had a good-sized staff, you wrote a well-regarded book on predator insects, and that your career had begun to fall apart after you published much of this research because you cautioned against the use of pesticide approval practices both in the approval and within the agency, that you were continuously penalized as retaliation against your findings, and efforts were put there to suppress your science. And this is actually the story that I heard from you. It was interesting to hear it actually from the lens or from the perspective of individuals at the Grass-Fed Exchange, because what I was told of you, Dr. Lundgren, was without a doubt being a truth teller. And you can have two sides of the coin here. Many people look at the truth teller as the whistleblower. So how has it been for you within the scientific community to deal with that? So some people praising you for your efforts, all the great work that you've done, telling the stories of this, but also many of your peers that you probably respect and they to you that don't align with that perspective.
Well, I guess that's a complicated question.
I saved that for the middle.
There's very little incentive to pursue controversial research topics, right? I mean, I don't get promoted depending on whether I'm doing the right thing with my science or not. I get promoted based on how many papers I publish and whether I, you know, kept my bosses happy and stuff like that. And honestly, I mean, there's a lot of penalties for pursuing controversial things like climate change or pesticide use or questioning the current system in general. And so it's a much safer route, especially when you have to take care of people that you care about, be they your colleagues or your the supervisees or your family. It becomes a much easier path just to do less controversial science and justify it in your mind that what you're doing is contributing to and helping and letting somebody else shoulder the load of really calling into question those more controversial aspects of food production or whatever. I guess on a personal level, I guess I just had to ask myself the question of why I got into science to begin with and what's the right thing to do. I didn't back down when I was told. And as a result, most of the people in my life were hurt by my decision. And that's a selfish thing, right? That was a selfish thing. But at the same time, the motivation was not selfish. It was, I think that people need to, God, this planet's facing some serious issues right now, and we need people that stand up and do the right thing for the right reasons, despite the consequences. And doesn't make it easy, though. And it doesn't, I don't know, I don't blame anybody for not. But as a result of the whistleblower suit that I ended up putting forward, the 200 other scientists within USDA came forward and said that they also had their science suppressed. And 200 other people went before me, and they didn't do anything about it, you know? That sucks. That's science.
Yeah.
It happens at the university. It happens throughout the federal government. That's science. That's how professional science works right now.
Well, to your credit for having a strong chin and being willing to do it, and maybe to look at it similar to what we're talking about with those investors, of it depends on what your horizon is. So maybe it's some short-term loss for some long-term gain, because I'm in alignment with you. I can't sleep at night without thinking that I'm doing something for the betterment of the planet, or for the world and stability that my kids will inherit. So
Right. If
we don't step up now, who will? And
Right. Will
it become too late? So that has been, I think that's a challenge for any pioneer in the space. And again, to your credit for casting that approach. And the fact that 200 of your peers followed suit and followed looking at from that perspective, that's a testament to it takes a person with some will to come forward. And I'll even continue that and say, boy, look what's happened within the EPA in this administration. Look what's happened across the board in all of our agencies, that we have to launch separate rogue organizations to keep them at check, or even things like a New York Times op-ed post that describes what we have to do to regulate our own leadership. So maybe the Band-Aid needs to be ripped off. And I guess we can all thank you, Jonathan, for that.
Yeah, thank you. Yep. Oh, no, yeah.
So
it is what it is.
It is what it is. Let's talk about moving forward, because I think what you've seemed to establish now, at least what you were expressing at some of these different events, is you've taken a lot of that knowledge, a lot of that research, and you're making it applicable in South Dakota and really for a much broader audience of how to move forward. So could you tell us a bit more what you're doing at Blue Dasher Farm Lab and Ecdysis Foundation?
Sure. Yeah, you got it. Yeah. Right. So, yeah, I mean, I tried to change the system from within, and that didn't work. You know, the farmers and the beekeepers kind of pointed out that maybe there was a better way of producing food, and that pesticides were having these adverse effects on bees and the environment, and the current scientific infrastructure really wasn't supporting that. And so I tried to change the system from within. That failed. And so it became really clear that the way that we change a paradigm isn't through top-down approaches, right? It isn't through government. It isn't through even the universities. And the government and the universities have a role to play there, but I really believe that paradigm shifts kind of come from the ground up. And it's already happening. And so to make our science as applicable as possible, I had to cut all the strings. I had to get out of the matrix. And so I quit my position, and we opened a research facility in regenerative agriculture. So it's focused on providing science to remove hurdles for the innovative farmers and ranchers and beekeepers out there. And so it's been really exciting. We actually crowdfunded it. So we reached out. We reached out to beekeepers, farmers, ranchers all over the world, and through small donations, they bankrolled a research facility, which that's never happened before. So I think it offers more testament to the to your earlier statement that, you know, there's a movement going on.
Do we see folks that you're working with materializing those economic costs if we didn't have bees, if we didn't have these systems? Have you seen any kind of true cost accounting on the states, within the states, that has been an effective approach of getting folks to really look at this differently?
Could you rephrase that question so that I understand what you're asking?
Of course. Just a little bit more? Of course. So, economically viable, you had mentioned economically viable approach, that people are looking at this differently. And one of the areas that has been of interest to the UN and many of the European models is looking at this idea of true cost accounting, where you start to integrate with subsidies, with externalized costs, with externalities associated to this, with the economic imprint of poor human health associated to a planetary impact. So really coming to an apples-to-apples comparison, are the people, are the early folks coming to you with these questions, with that understanding, and some kind of a matrix or some kind of an economic cost basis that would make sense in making an apples-to-apples comparison?
Boy, you know, not yet. I mean, many of the benefits of a regenerative system are difficult to put numbers on. But so necessary, right? And the farmers can feel what they're doing is correct, and they can see those benefits. It's difficult to, you know, translate that into economic gains. But certainly on a societal level, I think that that's a really necessary thing for us to do. If we were to look at the implications on a grand scale of our current monoculture-based food production systems, then man, I mean, I think we'd be shaking our heads and wondering why we've been subsidizing this approach for as long as we have.
Do we look at this in a broader perspective? Do we open up the aperture?
Well, I think we should.
Yeah.
Absolutely, I think we should. I mean, we need to be thinking about all of the implications, especially with the footprint that agriculture has on the environment, or on the landscape, right? You know, 10% of land surface of our country is just corn and soybeans. 30%, 34% of the land surface of the planet is devoted to food production. It gives us a real opportunity, right, for if we're managing that correctly, that gives us a huge opportunity for producing not only healthy food, but also for solving some of these planetary scale issues like climate change, like pollution, like human health.
Are there a specific, or is there a specific stakeholder within that group, the environmentalists, or the people that care about better food, or the individuals that are going to be the producers that just can't make this economically viable anymore with a conventional approach, that are going to be the driver of change towards this movement?
I think it's a little bit of all of those things. Ultimately, it's got to be the consumer that drives this, though, right? I mean, there has to be an awareness that is reached. Right now, I feel like, yeah, there is a growing sort of cognizance of how important healthy food is. And I think organic and the growth of the organic sector is kind of a testament to that. But there's also the producer angle, and the producers, you know, that are changing the way that they produce food in order to accommodate, do the right thing, I guess, on their own farms. And so melding, you know, the production side with the consumer side is going to be a really important event that needs to happen, right? And maybe it's happening already, but not at the scale that it needs to in order to really exact major change.
Well, I get a chance to deal quite a bit with the consumer side and the producer side, but less on the scientific side. And I found it interesting when you state that 200 individuals followed after you within the USDA as almost waiting for a pioneer to lead, and then maybe feeling their moral clause to come forward, that this is, you know, this is the mettle of the man here. This is the approach that we need to take. Are you seeing, since those, in the last couple of years, are you seeing a similar type scenario where more scientists are coming forward? A bit, maybe an analogy is what we saw within climate change 10 years ago, where we had some deniers within the scientific world, but we're pretty much at a consensus. Are we going to be in that same approach with scientists 10 years from now with regenerative agriculture?
No, I don't think that I've been seeing that, unfortunately. I would hope that, of course, there's a sliver of the scientific community, the agricultural community, that is, you know, forward thinking and trying to challenge what we know as far as ecologically based or regenerative agriculture. But the majority of farmers right now are still practicing very conventional agriculture. The majority of science is also sort of bent on making that broken system work, and always has been. And so they're not really challenging. That's why I think that, you know, I mean, man, at one point the land grant mission of the university systems was profound and ahead of its time. Abraham Lincoln started that. Talk about a forward-thinking guy. The idea that the federal government would give universities money so that they could conduct agricultural research without any strings attached, and then watching the destruction of that system or the dependence of that system suddenly shift over to, you know, large corporate dollars in order to keep these universities open, that has corrupted the science that comes out. I mean, it's got to follow the money. That doesn't mean that all science that comes out of universities is bad, not by a long shot, but it, you know, when they're working in the in some building that's been had its naming rights, you know, sold to the highest bidder, and you wonder where their motivations lie and where their priorities lie. And for the most part, I would argue that most of the science is trying to incrementally improve on a broken system rather than question whether or not that system was correct to begin with. And that's where what I'm hoping the next revolution in science kind of comes from, is from, you know, private sector, you know, maybe it's nonprofit, you know, research and development kinds of things that that have the correct mission and vision that maybe what the land grant university system used to have was their foundation.
Yeah, I mean, genuinely a tremendous idea, and the result being somewhat maniacal, maybe slightly genius in the approach that they've taken. But if they can change it to that extent in the last 30, 40 years, I think we can claw it back in even a shorter period in the information age. And especially if we are having a consensus between consumers and environmentalists and hopefully healthcare practitioners and maybe scientists as well, where we, by hook or by crook, we'll be moving in that direction no matter. Dr. Lundgren, if you could share with our audience where they may be able to learn more about your test farm lab and your foundation. Do you have a website that would be a good location for them to locate?
Sure, yeah. It's bluedasher.farm is one of our websites, and then ecdysis.bio. That's ECDYSIS.bio. ECDYSIS is the 501c3 research and development, research and education company, and then Blue Dasher Farm is sort of our public face of that science. So trying to make everything that we're doing as transparent as possible for the end users.
Well, keep up the great work. We are more than impressed here, and we welcome the ongoing conversations and continue to see what you roll out in coming years. And I'll just state that, looking at it from your, as you stated, that these principles, these systems approach to addressing the issues we have, current issues, whether it's with genetic engineering, whether it's with neonics, or whether it's with glyphosate, or whatever the methodology is, let's not get down the weeds and look at a better approach to this that includes no-till, cover cropping, biodiversity, cropland, and animal agriculture integration, and connect it with a movement. Stop with the band-aids. Let's look at this as a systems change and welcome that through better economic modeling. So, Dr. Lundgren, thank you so much for taking the time, and I'll say until next time.
Okay, sounds very good. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks again.